So we're going to go ahead and start this morning. So we heard a little bit about filtered back projections, some of the technical processing. So this morning, we're going to go ahead and spend a little bit more time going through that in detail. And Robert Pagninelli, who's the chief technologist at Duke, is going to go ahead and start with the technical aspects of acquisition and processing.
Thanks, Donna. Well, again, welcome back to day two. And again, we're going to be starting off with the technical aspects of acquisition and processing. For the next 45 minutes or so, I'd like to cover a few topics. Talk first about acquisition parameters and the various choices that we have when doing myocardial perfusion imaging. The importance of reviewing acquired data and the importance of the technologist in your lab understanding how to identify artifacts and making decisions whether or not studies or scans need to be repeated. Talk about image reorientation and the pitfalls and problems that can be caused when that's done improperly. Talk a bit about filters and how we come up with filters that we use and you know how they can be dangerous and what the limitations are. And finish up talking a little bit about recognition and resolution of artifacts. So the first question when we talk about acquisition is once we inject patients with these tracers that we use, when should we do the scan? So if you look at the guidelines, guidelines are similar for the two tech label tracers. Really, there's really no major differences between these two tech label tracers that we use, but you can image tetraphosphamine just a bit sooner, and really where that comes into play is with rest and pharmacologic stress injections. When patients walk on the treadmill and they reach an adequate endpoint, we can scan them very shortly after injection. The reason we don't want to do this 5 or 10 minutes after we do the injection is to be careful that we're not going to have upward creep artifact on the images. But as far as the hepatobiliary clearance, when patients do high-level exercise on the treadmill, that's often not a problem. So we're really worried about the rest and pharmacologic stress injections, where the tracer distribution is a good bit less favorable. So with SESTA, maybe the guidelines suggest that we wait 45 to 60 minutes after injection. And, again, we have to treat the pharmacologic stress injections the same way as the rest due to the tracer distribution patterns. For tetraphosphamine, again, it clears just a little bit quicker, and so we can get away with imaging those 30 to 45 minutes post-injection, with rest or pharmacologic stress studies. As far as processing these, and getting around the problems with the hepatobiliary clearance, when these are reconstructed, just some common sense should go in there that, all other anatomies that can be eliminated from the reconstruction is eliminated. And then very often with these tracers, probably 10 to 20% of the time, a decision's going to have to be made whether or not to rescan the patient, whether or not to just have them wait longer, to have them drink water, anything to kind of make the images look a little bit better. So we often don't see whole body pictures like this of a patient that's injected with a tech-labeled myocardial perfusion tracer, but rest injections, this is a sestamibi injection, and obviously when we inject these patients with rest and pharmacologic stress, there's a whole lot more activity in the liver initially than there is in the heart. And we'll look at some curves showing that were published basically showing the difference in tracer uptake in different organs. But, even an hour post-injection, you can see that there's still quite amount, a good bit of activity in the abdomen compared to the heart. But look how different the tracer distribution is when patients exercise on the treadmill. So what happens is blood typically, is going to be shunted away from the abdominal organs because there's an increased demand in the skeletal muscle. You can see a lot of uptake in the skeletal muscle that you don't see at rest. So we get just a better tracer, distribution. And this is, of course, a lot of the reason for doing low-level exercise with vasodilators. Yes, it lessens the side effects to some extent, but we get a much more favorable tracer distribution when patients are doing some exercise. These are old curves. These are from 1989, published in the Journal of Nuclear Medicine from a group at Yale, and basically just showing the amount of the percentage of tracer uptake in various organs. But this is actually the, you know, this yellow represents the river, the liver, and the blue represents the heart. And these curves actually show that with a rest injection of cestamibi, it's not until, you know, 80 minutes or so after injection that you have more activity in the heart than you do in the liver. So if anything, I think we probably scan a little bit earlier than what some of the literature, you know, says we should do. But again, look how different now at exercise. This is immediately following injection. Here's the liver activity. You can see that there's more activity in the heart immediately after an injection. So we typically don't have these problems. Here's some curves from the couple of years later when tetraphosphamide became available. And basically it shows the same thing. The rest curve now is on the right, but the liver activity is in red. The heart activity is in yellow. But again, remember that the tetraphosphamide clears a bit sooner. This curve is probably showing 45 or 50 minutes post-injection that there then is more activity in the heart than in the liver. And just like we saw with cestamibi, immediately following injection, there's more tracer activity in the heart than there is in the liver with the tetraphosphamide as well. So we have, you know, it, several times a day in our lab, and I'm sure in your lab and in all labs, it's really no different, but these are initial acquisitions that are done at the bottom. This particular patient had rest, one-day protocol with followed by pharmacologic stress, so it's 10 and 30 millicuries, and those were the initial acquisitions. Now, probably the rest study didn't necessarily need to be repeated, but the technologist chose to do so. So this is the initial rest, this is the initial stress acquisition, and they were both repeated due to the extra cardiac activity. But you know, the bottom line is, do you want to read the one on the bottom, or would you rather read the one on the top? You know, the truth is, in both of these instances, the patient came off of the camera, waited 20 or 25 minutes, then went back onto the camera and had the scan repeated. So, you know, a 30-minute wait, a 15-minute scan repeat. So, you know, when you add this all together, it made the study last about an extra hour and a half. But the bottom line is, it's a much easier study and a much clearer study to read. Kind of takes out the questionable part in the report. So not only does this affect perfusion images, or looking at the heart, but you know, you may or may not be able to get away with reading this study as far as the myocardial perfusion part. You can see that there's a lot of activity. It looks like it's actually, patient has an elevated left hemidiaphragm. You know, is this stomach activity or? But basically, this activity is up very high behind the heart, and it's. You know, not only does it affect the perfusion, but now the gated SPECT is going to be inaccurate. Can you read the wall motion? Sure. But any of the calculations that are going to show volumes and ejection fraction, obviously, are going to be inaccurate. And there are some overrides that we can put some input into these quantitative programs to try to have, for them to detect the myocardium a little better. It will consider input from the user. But in this situation, that didn't help. So the solution was to take this patient off of the table and rescan him. Can you advance for me? I can't get this to. There you go. Thanks. And got off the table, drank water because the activity was assumed to be in the stomach. Put him right back on the camera, 5 minutes later, and reacquired the study. So you can see it washed that activity out, and now it's a much clearer study to try to interpret. And more importantly, you can actually see what's going on with the gated SPECT now, and we're going to have accurate volumes and ejection fraction. All right. So, how long should we be scanning these studies? Looking at the guidelines, basically the consensus out there is that for low-dose studies, when we're using, and most are using 10 millicuries when we're doing one-day protocols, so a 10 millicurie dose, low dose, and the guidelines say 25 to 30 seconds per step. We always use the higher end of this in our lab, so we scan for 30 seconds a step. On a dual-headed system, that ends up being about a 16-minute scan. For high-dose studies, guidelines suggest 20 to 25 seconds. We scan in this range. A 20-second scan would be about a 20 seconds per step would result in about a 12-minute scan. Now, keep in mind that if you have a single-headed system, you basically have to double the scan time to have the same number of counts that you'd have with a dual-headed system. So that brings You know, then you're pushing 30, 32 minutes to do a low-dose study. And, you know, the thing that you have to consider then at that point is the longer you scan, the more likely the patient's going to move, and you're going to have to deal with some motion artifact. So, obviously, there's a big advantage to using dual-headed systems over single-headed systems. But, again, guidelines at, you know, 25 to 30 seconds for the lower dose, and for the higher dose, 20 to 25 seconds. All right, so other problems we deal with is, as I said, we scan them too long and we can end up with problems like this. So this is a one-day protocol. The patient actually had 12 and 36 millicuries. It was about 270 pounds. And, you know, the rest study is, you know, questionable, some fixed defect here, but at stress, this is textbook motion artifact. You can actually see the cinnae bouncing up and down, you know, you can actually, you know, looking at these slices, and this is where we always identify motion artifact is in these horizontal long axis images, and you can see that the septum's actually positioned higher than the lateral wall. So again, it's textbook motion artifact. You know, technologists definitely should be able to identify this, and it's a simple fix. One, if you have this degree of motion, I definitely wouldn't suggest trying to use the motion correction programs. If there's a slight amount of motion, those motion correction programs can be good. But we typically reserve that for very small amounts of motion or for patients who refuse, you know, to be rescanned or it was missed and they left the lab. But anyhow, in this case, you know, put the patient back on the table, we repeated the scan, and, you know, now there's, it looks like there's probably some fixed defect, but no more reversibility. So that's been erased with removing the motion artifact from the study. So sure, all of us, the routine way that we do these scans is to scan the patient in the supine position, but there are some advantages to adding a prone scan. With prone imaging, we get less inferior wall diaphragmatic attenuation artifact. And the other thing we can do is kind of flatten out the breast tissue and spread the breast attenuation over a larger area, more uniformly attenuate the heart, and it can be beneficial for breast attenuation artifact as well. Now, the reason that we don't just do prone imaging instead of supine imaging is that with prone imaging, we can get an artifactual anteroceptal defect due to increased sternal attenuation. So it's usually an adjunct, something we do in addition to the supine imaging and not as a replacement. Where prone imaging, you know, in my opinion, really comes into play is if you're not doing, you know, using attenuation correction acquisitions in your lab, it really becomes important to do this on patients that were unable to gait. You know, so we can't, you know, we don't have that wall motion, you know, to help distinguish diaphragmatic attenuation artifact from a true perfusion abnormality. Patients who are in atrial fibrillation, for example, and the R-to-R intervals all over the place, and we're going to have an inaccurate gait. You know, so this particular patient, you can see, has this, you know, what's going on with the inferior wall. Simply, we took the patient off the table, we turned him around, put him in the prone position, did about a 15-second per frame acquisition, so it was about a 7 or 8 minute scan, and you can see what the prone showed. So again, this is rest, low dose rest. This is high dose stress. These are both in the supine position, and this is the patient scanned in the prone position. So when we do prone imaging, the patient is laying prone, and we put the heads underneath the patient. So we're still going to do that same 180 degree acquisition. It's going to go from 45 degrees RAO to 45 degrees LPO. So we're still going to have that heart right in the center of that 180 degree acquisition. And again, guidelines say that we can decrease the time a little bit since this is kind of an adjunct to the supine imaging that we do. But now, you know, can be comfortable to say that this is diaphragmatic attenuation artifact as opposed to an infarct. Just another example, this is just showing stress-only imaging. This is the prone image here. And with the supine imaging, there's a questionable inferior wall abnormality. So this combination of supine and prone imaging is used to identify breast, but mostly inferior wall diaphragmatic attenuation artifact. There's also some publications saying that it helps with lateral chest wall fat attenuation as well. Typically, we don't gait patients in the prone position. We get that gaited information from the supine acquisition that we do. So we turn, again, the patient around into the prone position. We decrease the acquisition time by about 20 to 40%. And repeat the acquisition ungated. So energy windows. Like with most of the acquisitions that we do using tech label tracers and nuclear medicine, we use a 20% energy window. So again, this is basically when we have that 140 keV peak, we are going to go 10% in each direction. So 10% below and 10% above that 140 to set our energy window. You know, this is a setting that is done pre-acquisition. Once it's acquired, there's nothing you can do to change this. So it would have to be reacquired if it was initially acquired off peak. As far as collimators, should be using high resolution collimators. Of course, the big difference between the high resolution collimator and a general purpose or an all-purpose collimator, those two terms are pretty much interchangeable. So a low energy all-purpose or a low energy general purpose collimator basically allow more counts to come through. But in return, they're lower resolution. So these high res collimators, when we compare them to an all-purpose collimator, have longer bores, they have smaller holes, thicker septa, basically give better resolution. But the trade-off is there's a lot less counts, so it has to be a high count study. So it becomes a little debatable what's best for thallium because it's a lower count study. Do we use the high res or do we use an all-purpose collimator? You know, if it's dual isotope imaging, you know, which many aren't doing anymore, but definitely would suggest high resolution collimators. And you know, in using 4 millicuries of thallium, high resolution collimators still are probably better, but it's definitely acceptable to use an all-purpose or general purpose collimator. But for technetium imaging, should be a high resolution collimator. In comparing these two, probably get a little more than twice the counts with the general purpose collimator that you would get with a high resolution collimator. So there's a pretty significant difference in the count rate that we're going to get. But again, the trade-off is much better resolution. Orbits, touched on this when we talked about prone, but typically in nuclear cardiology, it's become the norm to do 180-degree acquisitions as opposed to 360-degree acquisitions. You know, when SPECT first started, it was somewhat common to have triple-headed cameras, so we got 360 degrees of imaging. It really didn't speed the acquisitions up because you had three heads, but you were imaging all the way around the body. Typically, they were 4-degree steps instead of three, so the imaging times are basically the same as using a dual-headed system and acquiring a 180-degree acquisition. But physicists argued and go back and forth. If we had two of them here, we'd probably get three different opinions on which is best. But it really seems that it has become the consensus that we're better off to just dedicate all the imaging time to these anterior projections and avoid the posterior projections where we're going to get a lot of scatter from the spine and acquire them in the 180 degree. So again, when we use 180 degree acquisition, it goes from 45 degrees RAO to 45 degrees LPO. So putting that heart or that best septal view we'd use for, if we were doing planar imaging, that would be the middle of that acquisition. So we're imaging 90 degrees in each direction from the, kind of putting the heart in the middle of that acquisition. So orbit types, a few different orbit choices that we have with some of our systems. With some systems, we're locked into using one or the other. We don't have a choice. But just as it is important to understand the differences between the two. And what's very important if it is a system that gives choices, are the technologists doing the same thing? So number one, circular orbits. That's traditionally the way that these were done. It's very simple that it travels the same distance in its orbit all the way around. A non-circular orbit is either elliptical, where it's closer on top and bottom than it is on the sides, because most patients are wider from side to side than they are from front to back. So it's an elliptical orbit, or a body contouring. What body contouring is the cameras utilize lasers, laser lights basically to automatically have the heads as close to the patient in each one of the projections. So there's either circular or non-circular orbits, and there's two choices with non-circular, again, the elliptical and the body contouring. Now, talking about circular orbits, again, it's a fixed radius all the way around the acquisition. On average, you're going to have greater detector difference because, you know, again, most patients are going to be wider from side to side than they are from front to back. So you're going to have increased distance anteriorly than you would with a non-circular orbit. So a non-circular orbit is going to more so follow the contour of the patient. But, you know, the downside to this is you theoretically can have some imaging artifacts created because you have variation of your source to detector difference. The bottom line is, I think it's very difficult to argue that one of these is better than the other. Again, this just kind of shows each one of these in a drawing, but you can see with a circular orbit, you're probably going to have a little more distance anteriorly and posteriorly because it's, again, a fixed radius. With a body contouring, it's more elliptical, and so you're going to decrease some of that distance anteriorly. The bottom line is whichever one of these is being used needs to be as close as possibly can be to the patient. And the other thing is the same one definitely needs to be used. Of course, you don't want to use a circular on the rest and then use the non-circular on the stress because you can see differences in the projections and make the interpretation that, you know, confusing or even inaccurate. The other thing is you want to have this policy in your lab because if somebody comes for a follow-up study, you want it to be acquired the same way. So sometimes when we have choices, we can get into trouble, but we do need to make sure that we're doing all the studies the same way. Acquisition type, so a couple more choices that we have. Most of the time, most of us, our labs, are doing step-and-shoot acquisitions. What that means is the camera moves a few degrees, it stops, it begins to acquire data, it acquires that data for 30 seconds, it stops acquiring, then it rotates 3 more degrees, and then it starts to acquire again, so step-and-shoot. The alternative is to do a continuous acquisition. With continuous acquisitions, the cameras never stop. They constantly move at a very, very slow rate. So there's pluses and minuses. What are the pros? Well, you get more counts because you don't have that dead time that the camera stops acquiring to move into its next projection. The con is that you have your acquiring as that camera is moving, so you potentially lose a bit of resolution. Some camera systems have a kind of a combination of the two, called a continuous step and shoot. Again, most systems don't have this, but if you have it, just understanding what it is it's just like the step and shoot, but as it rotates the 3 or 4 degrees to the next projection, it actually acquires some data. So as far as number of projections, it's pretty standard for us to have 60 to 64 projections in our technetium acquisitions. The only time that 30 or 32 steps would be appropriate if you're doing thallium imaging and you're using an all-purpose collimator, a general-purpose collimator. If you're doing thallium imaging with a high-resolution collimator, again, you're better off to use the 60 to 64 frames because you're going to have a little bit better resolution. So gated SPECT, would hope that this is being acquired with all studies in the lab. Obviously, we don't charge for this anymore, but there's lots of reasons to have it. We, of course, get the EF information. We get the wall motion and thickening information. We get volume estimates. But the important thing is when we were showing the prone imaging, we get improved specificity by the ability to identify artifacts, particularly anterior wall breast attenuation and in inferior wall diaphragmatic attenuation. So one thing that's real important to understand and very likely board questions is just understanding that these are post-stress ejection fractions that we get when we on our stress acquisitions. So when these are being interpreted, looking at a peak stress myocardial blood flow perfusion pattern, but it's actually a real-time gated SPECT acquisition. So, that may be 30 to 45 minutes after the stress. So these peaks, these post-stress ejection fractions are more similar to a resting ejection fraction, although, publications say they're still different, but it's closer to a resting ejection fraction than it's going to be to a peak stress ejection fraction that, for example, we can get with first pass imaging or MUGA imaging. These can be slightly higher than a resting ejection fraction if you image soon after because increased catecholamines in the system make it higher than the rest. If patients have severe perfusion abnormalities at stress, there can be myocardial stunning, and therefore, even though there's a delay before the acquisition, there can be a drop in ejection fraction compared to rest. So just understanding that these are not peak stress, they're not rest, they're a post-stress ejection fraction. So just an example, this is a patient that has a severe perfusion abnormality. You can see that it's in the territory of the LAD, maybe a normal variant at rest, possible perfusion defect, but clearly comes very abnormal at stress. So the resting ejection fraction shows a normal EF of 56%, normal wall motion, and that area that becomes ischemic becomes hypokinetic on the post-stress ejection fraction. This post-stress ejection fraction, this post-stress data was acquired about 45 minutes post, you know, stress testing. So, you know, if there is severe ischemia, there can be stunning that far out, but it's not very common. Obviously, it can happen. Again, another patient here with inferior wall, you know, potential diaphragmatic attenuation versus artifact. But obviously, with having the gated SPECT imaging, you can see that the inferior wall is moving and be comfortable to read this as diaphragmatic attenuation artifact versus an inferior wall infarct. So hopefully, again, we're gating all of these patients. So a couple of choices we have with gated SPECT. Do we want to use 8 frames in our gate? Do we want to use 16 frames in our gate? Either one is okay. You know, when we have the more frames we have, the better our temporal resolution is going to be. So it's going to be a more accurate representation of ejection fraction. With using 8 frames, publications, you know, have proven that we slightly underestimate our ejection fraction. We're going to slightly underestimate in diastole, and we're slightly going to overestimate in systole. So we're going to have a resultant slight drop in ejection fraction to what it would be if we acquired 16 frames. Thing to keep in mind, especially if you're gating the rest acquisitions with a low dose, or if you are using thallium ever and having problems with the edge detection or, you know, detecting the myocardium to do the EF calculation, with 8 frames, you're going to have twice as many counts in each bin as you do with 16 frames. 16 bins is going to divide those counts in each projection into 16 versus an 8. So you have a lot less counts for tracking the myocardium. So if there's problems with tracking, the option is to go back to 8 frames. But again, probably with the, you know, even with 10 millicurie injections of technetium, probably going to be fine to do 16 frame acquisitions. And again, that's going to give better temporal resolution. Other things to look out for as far as acquisitions and positioning, and again, really the key to acquisitions are making sure that everything is done the same way. But in this particular case, it's from several years ago, I think is a great teaching case. Again, it's a one-day protocol with a low-dose rest and a high-dose stress. And on the resting study, the female patient actually had her arms crossed and up over her forehead during the acquisition. And when she came back for the stress part, she told the technologist that she felt like she was claustrophobic, so she just wanted to put her arms up this way. And as a result, the breast position was in a different place at stress than it was at rest. So at rest, when the arms were over her forehead, the breast was positioned just a bit lower where it attenuated the entire heart. On the stress study, the arms were up higher, the breast was positioned up higher, and it attenuated the anterior wall, but it didn't attenuate the inferior wall. So the breast shadow goes right through the middle of the heart. Just the importance of the technologist having the patient in the exact same position for 2 acquisitions. So the patient went back and put the arms in the same position that they were at rest, repeated the stress image, and now it looks like a normal study. So again, arm position, very important, especially for females, but pectoral muscles in males can have this same type of effect. So again, reproducibility, I can't say enough. Lindsay had talked yesterday about how these cameras are most efficient and do the best imaging when we position the object of interest right in the middle of the field of view. So we typically do try to put the heart right in the middle of the field of view. Again, however it is at rest, we should try to do it at stress. We want reproducibility on everything, the patient positioning, where their arms are specifically, with the orbits. We want them to be mapped the same way at stress as they were at rest. We want to use the same type of orbit, circular and non-circular orbit, for both the rest and stress study. And the same if we're gating our rest and our post-stress images, we should use the same number of bins in one that we are in another. So following acquisition, kind of moving into processing here, the technologist should be the one that has the first eyes on this acquired data and trying to make a decision whether or not it needs to be repeated. There's so much information that we can gain from looking at the projection data on myocardial perfusion images. The first thing that the tech obviously should be looking for is motion artifact. Is there horizontal motion? Is there vertical motion? You know, often with horizontal motion, it's more difficult to correct with motion correction algorithms. Usually, in pretty much all cases in our lab, when we have horizontal motion, we'll repeat the study. Again, vertical motion, even if it's slight motion, again, better to repeat the study than it is to try to use the motion correction algorithms. Always want to look at the distribution of tracer, look for evidence of infiltration. You know, remember, if this dose is, you know, partially infiltrated. It's going to drain to lymph nodes, so often you'll see axillary uptake. Is there extra cardiac interference? Is there significant tracer in the liver or in the GI tract that's causing problems specifically with the inferior wall? Is there contamination? The technologist can be sloppy with the injection and have contamination outside the patient and that actually can affect the normalization of the images. Areas of abnormal uptake. Obviously, you're not going to try to diagnose areas that have abnormal uptake, but definitely those things need to be mentioned in the report and suggest further imaging to figure out why that tracer uptake is there. Attenuation patterns, you know, identifying breast and diaphragmatic attenuation on the raw data, and flickering would be another big thing to look at on these cinnae. So if the cinnae is flickering, it's indicative of a problem with the gating. And dependent on the system, a bad gait may or may not affect the perfusion images, so it's very important that the physicians and technologists understand exactly what happens to the perfusion images if there's a problem with the gated SPECT acquisition. So assuming that we have good acquired data and it's time to move into processing, the very first step in processing is doing the reconstruction volume. With some systems, this is simply putting limits just slightly above and slightly below the heart, picking what we're going to include in the reconstruction. And then some of them actually have this extra ellipse or circle that we're going to put over the heart to try to eliminate other anatomy from the processing. Additional things that we can look at for motion, in addition to that projection data, is these sinograms. What these sinograms are basically each of our 60 frames stacked upon one another. So if you take a projection, such as this anterior one here, and almost smash it down so it's just a very thin line, that's what you see at the very top here. And then it's 2 all the way through 60, all the way down. So this is the heart right here. And this is probably liver activity right here. But these, if you can see that the heart is basically a solid line, but any time you would see a break where there's actually a line going through horizontally here would be indicative of motion. So again, this is just a tool. There's also, so again, it's a sinogram and it's a tool to help identify motion artifact. But in this case, it's very solid and not showing any evidence of patient motion. So what can do, if you do this step of the processing inaccurately, simply we truncate. We could see in that previous study that the heart was positioned right in the middle of the field of view like we wanted it to, but the processing was just done too close, basically, and truncated off the inferior wall of the heart. Another example of the same thing, you can actually look at the raw projection data and see that the heart was positioned correctly, not only at rest, but at stress, but the processing just truncated off the inferior wall. So just processing errors that can happen, technologists being a little careless during processing. Next step moving through processing of studies is axis reorientation. So, you know, doing imaging, you know, in other modalities that are not cardiology, we're used to reconstructing images, to the long axis of the body, so sagittal, coronal, and transaxial projections. But with cardiac imaging in various modalities, it's standard, of course, to rotate these to the long axis of the heart. So we create short axis, horizontal, and vertical long axis images. And definitely mistakes can happen at this step, and they can be pretty costly ones and things that can be easily overlooked and cause inaccurate reporting. But if this is done correctly, this axis should be placed right through the center of the myocardium. So it should go through the apex and right through the middle of the base of the heart. When this is done at an incorrect angle, remember, cuts are going to be made 90 degrees to this or perpendicular to this axis that we put through the heart. So it may catch myocardium on one side, but it's going to miss on the other side. So take, for example, if it was done this way at rest and then it's done incorrectly at stress, It's just cutting through at different angles, and it can make it look like there's a perfusion abnormality when it's just poor processing. So a lot of time does need to be taken at this step. Issues can happen clearly. So as we cut through horizontal long axis and vertical long axis and short axis images, if this is done correctly, again, the key to the processing is making sure that it's done the same way. If the axis is done incorrect at rest and incorrect at stress, but it's done incorrectly the same, it's not as big of an issue. So again, consistency is the main point to take away from this. Again, this is just showing a perfusion study, obviously, that's processed correctly. Each of the slices matches up at rest and stress. We want the rotation of these vertical long axes to be the same. On this particular system, we always try to make them point at 3 o'clock. With some systems, you don't have the ability to change the direction that these vertical long axis images, but you always have the ability to point how these horizontal long axis images are going to point. And those are typically pointed up at 12 o'clock. But again, you want them to be pointing the exact same way at rest as they do at stress. Now keep in mind, however these perfusion images are processed, that data and the rotation of that data is going to be passed on to the quantitative programs. And these quantitative programs, you can guarantee, are processed or created from studies that were processed correctly. So if the study that was actually acquired in your lab is processed incorrectly, basically inactivates these, and it's going to make it look like there's defects in areas where there's really not defects. So take a look at this study here, see if I can convince you that there's a potential reversible defect in the lateral wall here, looking at these short axis images. But take a closer look and look at the horizontal long axis images. So they're rotated in different directions. And looking at the lateral wall on those horizontal long axis images, it's hard to find that same defect. Where is it? You should see it on different cuts, but you're only seeing it on the short axis. And this is a processing problem here. This is just that these are processed incorrectly. This is the same study with the heart oriented correctly, and looking at this area, you don't see anything reversible now. So again, just simple things like this that can be overlooked during interpretation. So point to be made, make sure that you actually see the quality control and see where this long axis is drawn through the heart to make sure that it's done consistently at rest and stress. Looking, again, cuts are going to be made perpendicular to the long axis that's put through the heart. Just looking down here, this is an example. If it's done one way at rest and it's done one way at stress, it doesn't need to be off very much. If this is off a few degrees, you can see how different that the cuts are going to be made as it goes through the heart. So obviously, they're not going to match. So being off just a few degrees can cause, the images to look significantly different. Again, reiterating the point that whatever happens in this process data is going to be carried over into the quantitative programs. Here's one done correctly, but when it's done incorrectly, and now it's creating an abnormality in the lateral wall. Again, it's just a processing problem. This is one of the common quantitative programs out there. This is the quality control page where you can see where limits are put as to where the myocardium begins and where the myocardium ends. So it's done correctly at the base here on the rest study. A little tight at the apex, but it's okay. It probably needs to be out a little more toward the apex. Now look how loose it's processed on the stress study. Done pretty well at the base, but there's some space here between the apex and where the technologist has the limit set. So what's going to happen? It's going to take this data, it's going to bring it into the bullseye, and it's going to make it look like there's a reversible defect in the apex of the heart. Again, nothing but the processing data. So hopefully these are being used to assist with interpretation, but the interpretation not based on these comparisons to normal databases. Again, processing problems can create problems. And this is, of course, if the limits are put correctly now, you can see that the defect goes away as you would expect. Other issues that can happen with processing is including non-cardiac uptake inside in the processing or in the normalization. In this particular case, obviously this heart isn't uniformly ischemic here at stress, but we have this extra cardiac activity that's actually hotter than anything in the myocardium at stress, and the study's normalizing to it. Now, a word of caution is what some technologists I've seen do is they just put their mouse over the stress study and they crank up the intensity. So, very dangerous, obviously. If they pull it up too high, defects can be covered up. If they don't bring it up quite enough and you don't realize they've changed it, they can make it look like there is a perfusion abnormality. So it's very key that this normalization happens automatically by the computer. Or technologists should leave it this way and let you know as the interpreter, but they shouldn't be trying to change the intensity manually themselves. Now, most of these processing programs allow us to use masking, where we actually cover up this extra cardiac activity. So this is actually the same study utilizing a mask now, so it's covering up this activity that I'm pointing to here, and now the system is actually normalizing to the activity in the heart versus the activity outside the heart. So obviously this extra cardiac activity causes problems with the tracking. We had shown a similar example earlier in the lecture, but you know, this is a case where there's different versions of these quantitative programs out there. Some of them allow us to go in as users and put points or put, you know, tell the computer where we know that the myocardium is, and that will then consider our input. Sometimes it overrides our input, but sometimes it will take our input. Now, in this particular version of the software, it allows absolutely no input from the user. So what was interesting about this version of the software is even if we utilize a mask that would cover this activity up, this software would not translate, would not carry that mask into the quantitative program. So you could mask it on the perfusion images, but it wouldn't take that masked information into the quantitative program. And so the computer is actually drawn, you know, thinking that the heart is between this extra cardiac activity and the interventricular septum instead of tracking the heart, totally missing the heart. And again, nothing you could do on this particular software version except take the patient off and rescan them and try to get rid of this extra cardiac activity. But there was no way, you know, we do have software limitations that prevent us from fixing some things where sometimes only a rescan will help. This is a newer version of the software. And, you know, all these software programs have limitations, but there's no inferior wall in this heart. So it's just natural that this program is trying to grab something inferiorly, and I don't believe that this is actually myocardium down here. It's just grabbing some extra cardiac activity, and it's going to throw off the volumes, obviously, in the calculation. But this shows you there is an override here. So in this particular version, we go up to manual processing. It gives us these data points, which we drag over the myocardium. These are all interactive, so you move on one plane, it's going to adjust it on other planes. But the newer versions of all of these programs do, you know, if it's a version from the last couple of years, you can go in as a user and again have some input as to where it draws these endocardial and epicardial regions. But again, even though we put these data points where we want them, the computer may use them and it may not. It's going to consider it, but it's not always an absolute override to what the computer wants to do. But keep in mind that you can have some user input. All right, I want to talk next a little bit about filters. And, you know, we're not going to get into this in depth like physicists will, but understanding the things that we can control in our labs and what happens when we make adjustments to these filters. So first of all, why do we use filters? Well, you know, when most of us are using filtered back projection to do our reconstructions. And when you talk about simple back projection, a star artifact is going to be created when we do simple back projection. So what filtered back projection is removing that inherent star artifact that's created from doing back projection. What makes back projection filtered back projection is a ramp filter. A ramp filter is the filtered and filtered back projection. A point to take away from this is a ramp filter, remember, is always going to be used with filtered back projection. You, I, any technologist can't turn that ramp filter off. The ramp filter is always going to be used. Again, it's the filtered and the filtered back projection. Then we choose our Butterworth or our other type of filter we're going to be used. So the ramp filter is going to get rid of the star artifact, basically. We also want to filter because we want to obviously optimize the signal-to-noise ratio, and we want to provide image enhancement before the interpretation is going to be performed. So again, here's simple back projection. When data is back projected, a star artifact is created, and what the ramp filter does is basically removes the star artifact as part of the reconstruction. So you probably will be asked that a ramp filter is always used in filtered back projection. It's not something that we turn off, or adjust parameters of. It's always going to be used. So what do you think of this study here? You know, reversible defect, pretty severe reversible defect in the right coronary territory. Now the ramp filter can be dangerous. I believe Dr. DePuy, when he lectured on artifacts, talked about a ramp artifact. And anytime you have hot activity that's in the same plane of the heart, and it looks like my cines aren't moving this one, I apologize for that, but basically there's hot activity that's behind the heart that you can see, and you can actually see it on the images here. But This is an artifact caused from the filtered back projection. So you have you imagine a star artifact that's going through the inferior of the wall of the heart. The ramp filter tries to fix that. It's actually pulling counts out of the inferior wall of the heart. This is the same study with the patient taken off the table, drinking water, washing out that stomach activity, and reacquiring the data 10 minutes later. What to look out for, how can this happen? Well, ramp artifacts happen every day when we do myocardial perfusion imaging, but this is a worst case scenario here. But a couple of things that throw up a red flag: very hot activity at the same plane of the heart. And looking underneath it here, you have an area that looks like there's no counts. So counts were falsely pulled away. Unless the patient has some type of lead on them when you do the acquisition, there's no way that you should actually see this. So that throws up a red flag of a ramp artifact. Again, worst case scenario, but it does happen. So why else do we want to do filtering? Even with high resolution collimators, we're going to have counts that actually get through at incorrect angles. So what may be a very small lesion or difference in the heart is actually going to spread out, what's called a point spread effect, and even worse is a line spread effect, where you can have points, photons crossing over one another and basically putting bad counts or noise in our studies. So there's a couple of parameters that we want to understand when we talk about Butterworth filters. The cutoff frequency or the critical frequency. When you see those two terms, whether or not they should be, they're pretty much used interchangeably. So you will see cutoff frequency, critical frequency. Again, they're interchangeable terms. But these basically specify the bandwidth of the filter. And the frequency cutoff controls which frequencies are passed and which frequencies are going to be suppressed to showing up in the final images. The lower the critical frequency, the more influence there is from surrounding data points, and the more blurred the images are going to become. So when you lower the critical frequency or the cutoff frequency, it degrades the resolution of the images. You're creating a smoother image, but you're losing resolution at the expense. All right, so critical frequency, cutoff frequency, the lower it is, the more blurred the images are going to be, you're going to lose resolution as we do this. The other big parameter that we have with the Butterworth filter is the order or the power. The order and the power, again, two terms that are used pretty much interchangeably. But these vary the slope of the filter function, and it basically optimizes the trade-off between smoothness and sharpness. And if you play with filters a little bit, you're going to see that this order has a little less, obvious effect on the data than the critical frequency does. So just looking at this in a little more detail, here's a study where we leave the order of the power exactly the same, but changing only the critical frequency, you can see what happens to the images here. So this is probably an optimal critical frequency. It's 0.4, all right? If we lower that critical frequency down to a 0.2, you can see how much it blurs the image. And on the alternative, if we raise it from a 0.4 to a 0.6, you can see how noisy, but the image is more higher resolution. But again, it's not quite as smooth. So as we move this critical frequency from a high down to a lower number, we're blurring the image, losing some resolution. On the other hand, here's the order, where you can see it called the power over here. Again, they will often be used interchangeably. If we leave the critical frequency the same and now we adjust the power, you can see a power of 1 where it looks not very smooth. And as we raise it higher and higher, it becomes more of a smooth image. Typically, with a Butterworth filter, we're using somewhere around a 0.4 for the critical frequency and then a 10 for the order of the power, which is in between these two pictures. So those are common parameters, but those are the two big things that we adjust when we talk about filtering, specifically Butterworth filters. A couple of things to keep in mind. With thallium, it's a lower energy. There's going to be more scatter. There's less counts. Overall, we're going to use more filtering on thallium than we're going to use on a technetium images. We have more counts. We have higher resolution with thallium, with technetium, so we don't need to blur it as much. We don't have to remove as much noise. So look at these images here. These are the technetium images here. These are the same image. This is a tech image, and these are thallium images over here. Looking at the frequency cutoff, so this is a frequency cutoff of 0.65, which doesn't look bad on the technetium image, but if we're using that same filter parameter on the thallium, you can see that it doesn't look very smooth. It's a very ugly looking picture. Moving up to the top now, the cutoff frequency of 0.35, for the thallium here, looks pretty good, but it's probably over-filtering the technetium study. So typically, again, you're going to see lower critical frequencies or cutoff frequencies for thallium than you do for technetium. This is the same image right here. Unfortunately, just shows what filters can do to images. It's a normal, here it's over-filtered, where it's taken away a defect that's probably real. So if you over-filter, obviously you're going to lose sensitivity. You're going to blur the image and cover up defects. If you under-filter, you're going to lose some specificity also. You're going to call defects that aren't really there. And talking about gated SPECT images, remember gated SPECT images, you're looking at 1/8 or 1/16 of the counts in the projection. When those are blown up at end diastole, they're going to look a little bit count poor. This is how filtering should look on a gated SPECT at end diastole. If it looks this way at end diastole, if it's filtered this much, when it goes to end systole, you're probably not even going to see a cavity. It's just going to obliterate the cavity because the image is so blurred. So this is the way things should look on your gated SPECT images. Again, just looking at critical frequency here again, this is obviously the same study here. This is a higher critical frequency. As we move to a lower critical frequency and we further blur this image, look what happens to the sum stress score. So the more we filter image, it's going to blur out and make a defect look smaller. So in closing, really talking about filters here, you know, when you come up with a new system, you have a new system in your lab, application specialist is going to come in and work with you and the technologist and say, all right, these are the filters we recommend for this system. And you're going to have input. Well, I like my images a little less smooth than that, or I like my images a little more smooth than that. And so these filters will be tweaked. And once you come up with something you're happy with, that's what should be used on every patient. Don't want to get into the habit, well, this patient's a little bigger, so I'm going to use a little more filtering. Or, you know, the change in filters is basically reserved for something extreme where a dose is infiltrated and you're trying to utilize the data. But, you know, come up with what works for you, and it should be used the same for every patient. Again, consistency, definitely don't want to get into changing this from patient to patient. Just want to dedicate just a slide or two talking about iterative reconstruction. Iterative reconstruction is very different from filter back projection. You don't have a ramp filter with iterative reconstruction. Iterative reconstruction basically has an estimate of basically where it thinks count should be. It comes up with a strategy for improving it, and it does an additional iteration. And so it has a closer estimate. Then it goes through another iteration and basically tries to come closer to where its estimate to where these counts should be. It is not used as commonly as much as filtered back projection. I think we're going to see more and more of it. As we move into these solid state systems, all of these solid state systems that incorporate resolution recovery into our processing are utilizing iterative reconstruction. A couple of reasons it really hasn't taken off at this point is that the iterative reconstruction algorithms have been there for years, but basically the computations, the processing to do iterative reconstruction are 20 to 30 times longer what they are for filtered back projection. So going back 10 years ago when it took us, 5 or 6 minutes to reconstruct a gated SPECT study, it would have taken 20 or 30 times longer to do that for iterative reconstruction. So the computer power wasn't there, but it is now, and again, it's being utilized for these solid state systems. Another reason is that all of these normal databases that are in our systems are derived from patients that are processed with filtered back projection. If you go in and use iterative reconstruction, theoretically those normal databases aren't comparable anymore because you're using a different type of processing. So overall, it really hasn't been proven to be superior, but it's the way that it has to be done when we incorporate resolution recovery algorithms that are now available to us. So the bottom line is we're going to start seeing more and more of it, but it's still not used very frequently in nuclear cardiology compared to filtered back projection at this time. In conclusion, the first step of, the key thing to remember about acquisition is consistency. There are a lot of choices out there, but we want to try to keep things uniform. The first step of processing is evaluating the raw data, and I can't stress enough how important it has been in my learning and how it's made our lab work well, is physicians actually spending, and it's become mandatory for fellows and training to spend time in the lab with the technologists, actually seeing acquisitions and seeing the pitfalls the technologists run into with acquisitions and where limitations are with patients. And likewise, the technologists actually spending time in the reading room and seeing where things are difficult interpretation-wise for the physicians. You know, how is this extra cardiac activity affecting interpretation? And basically, you know, allowing the groups to learn from each other and come up with what's best for the patient and best for the studies. Just consistency, again, is the most important thing with both the acquisition and processing. So I'm going to go ahead, looks like I'm running over just a little, go ahead and stop at that point, and thanks very much for your attention.